So the last speaker of this session is Jacqueline Torres. She is a third-year doctoral student in the Department of Community Health Sciences in the UCLA School of Public Health.
Okay, thank you. So I'm going to be talking about multinational determinants, revised from binational determinants of immigrant health, which I described in my abstract. So we have no financial relationships to disclose. So the starting point for this paper was the extension of a critique that has been made of studies of Latino immigrant health in particular that focus singularly on acculturation as the primary concept or primary predictor of health outcomes. So in a 2007 Social Science and Medicine article, Biruwa Fuentes suggests quite accurately, I believe, that the focus on acculturation often comes at the expense of social and structural conditions of inequality, such as forms of immigrant-based discrimination. So we extend this argument and identify another issue with the predominant focus on acculturation in Latino health research in general, namely that this concept necessarily focusing on the receiving context alone often crowds out any consideration of the full set of migration circumstances that we should understand in talking about immigrant health, including measures of pre-migration circumstances, as well as the circumstances in the receiving context, like such as exposure to discrimination based on immigrant status and other social and structural inequalities. So this complete set of multinational determinants of immigrant health is represented in Figure 1, which we adapt from the migratory phases framework presented by Zimmerman and colleagues in PLOS Medicine earlier this year. So we conceive of the complete life course for immigrants as encompassing all of these migratory phases, pre-migration, migration transit, the circumstances of reception, as well as continued cross-border ties, either through circular migration or cross-border relationships, visits and contact with family and friends in places of origin. So today I'll present work that focuses just jointly on pre-migration and reception context in adding to existing models of Latino immigrant health. I have some other projects on cross-border relationships that I don't have time to talk about today. So it may seem like common sense to people focused on refugee health, but I just thought I'd review why pre-migration circumstances matter. And I think in the broader Latino health literature, it wouldn't be immediately present if you were to just do a general review of this literature. So pre-migration context serve as the location in which childhood health and socioeconomic conditions come about, and even adult health and socioeconomic conditions. So for researchers who are interested in the perspective of the entire life course, we find that earlier life conditions can have a persistent effect on later health outcomes, even with significant transitions such as migration. Stressors surrounding the decision to migrate and migration transit may have a persistent impact on physical and mental health. In addition, sociologists writing about segmented assimilation who acknowledge multiple pathways of immigrant settlement, including acculturation, suggest that pre-migration circumstances, as well as the decision-making and planning around migration, often contribute to different paths of settlement that different immigrant groups take, broadly construed, including acculturation patterns. So we've talked even today, and we know much more about why circumstances of reception matter from the research literature, but in our study, we're highlighting migration-related stressors, such as discrimination, including heightened scrutiny or surveillance given immigrant status and other structural and social conditions that might negatively impact health outcomes. So there's been some research, and a lot of it has come from the refugee literature on the long-term impacts of political violence in countries of origin on migrants long after being in the U.S., as well as a growing research on stresses related to documentation status and fears of deportation, and then a few studies, qualitative and quantitative, on the role of cross-border social networks and kind of continued contact and relationships in countries of origin. So along all of these phases, these migratory phases. Um, let's see. So my research questions with the focus of pre-migration factors is, do migration circumstances with this special focus on pre-migration circumstances influence the mental and physical health of Latino immigrants? Is it above and beyond measures that have traditionally been linked to acculturation? Do these effects differ by gender? And are these relationships between migration circumstances and health different for different Latino subgroups? So we use the National Latino and Asian American Survey. We focus only on the foreign-born Latino respondents. The two dependent variables are the Kessler 10 scale of nonspecific psychological distress, which includes measures of depressive and anxiety symptoms, and a measure of self-rated physical health, which has been discussed here, but we make it binary, contrasting excellent and very good health with good, fair, and poor, and that's related to the translation issues between Spanish and English of that measure, which I don't have time to go into. Pre-migration context variables were, respondents were asked whether or not they had to migrate versus wanting to migrate, and whether or not their migration was unplanned or planned. So these are subjective measures of respondents' own feelings about whether or not they had to migrate or that their migration was unplanned, and may indicate a range of personal, social, political, or economic conditions in respondents' places of origin. This is a national sample including many different Latino subgroups. The measure of migration circumstances in the reception context was the immigration domain of the Hispanic Stress Inventory, which has 9 questions about social and interpersonal stressors, such as guilt related to leaving family and friends behind in one's country of origin, as well as measures of discrimination based on immigration status, such as being questioned about your documentation status, fears about accessing health services due to what was at the time INS, reports, and then I have a number of covariates which are listed up there, including 2 commonly linked as proxies of acculturation, English language proficiency, and time in the U.S., as well as a scale of family cultural conflict, which has been shown to be a really important kind of predictor of psychological health outcomes related to disparate levels of acculturation within families. Just really briefly, although having to migrate and unplanned migration seem like highly collinear constructs, I just show a measure of Pearson chi-squared test showing that these are actually very different measures within the study. So they're getting at two distinct aspects of migration circumstances. And I can go into maybe in the question and answer period about some of these different predictors that I found of these circumstances, but I'll keep going. So I use ordinary least squares regression for the measure of psychological distress and binary logistic regression of self-rated physical health. And I do separate analyses for men and women, and I test interaction terms between Latino subgroup and these two migration, pre-migration measures. So briefly, women had higher distress scores than men, although they were at the low end of the scale, which ranges between 10 and 50 for both. Men were more likely to report being in excellent or very good physical health. About a third of respondents reported having to migrate versus wanting to migrate, and about 45% between men and women reported unplanned migration. And then the immigration-related stress scores were at the low end of the scale on about 2.5 points on the 9 item scale. Here I show bivariate relationships for psychological distress. I just want to highlight briefly that having to migrate and unplanned migration are both significant predictors of higher psychological distress scores for women only. And then immigration-related stress is significantly associated with higher distress, psychological distress for both men and women. But moving on to the multivariate analysis, I show here for women only in the sample the interaction term between having to migrate and Latino subgroup. So Puerto Ricans are the reference group here, and then Cuban, Mexican, and other Latinos. And so I show that the final test at the end shows that the overall interaction term is significant, meaning that the the relationship between different Latino subgroup and the kind of predicted psychological distress score depends on whether or not they had to reported having to migrate or wanting to migrate. And I show that graphically here. So whereas the yellow bars are just the bivariate relationship between predicted distress scores for different Latino subgroups, you see when you actually consider whether they reported having to migrate or wanting to migrate, you get very different results depending on that response. So these are predicted scores of psychological distress, and they vary significantly for different groups. And this is women only again. So moving on to the results of the binary logistic regression, here the immigration-related stress scale and the scale of family cultural conflict, which were significantly related to psychological distress, are no longer significant. And it looks at first that with the exception of unplanned migration for women, none of the pre-migration variables are significant here either in these bivariate relationships. However, moving on to the full multivariate model, I report the results for the interaction term between men, for men only, between, again, Latino subgroup and unplanned migration. Again, showing that there is a significant, that the relationship between Latino subgroup and the odds of reporting very good physical health depend on whether or not respondents reported their migration as planned or unplanned. So while for women we got significant results for this migration decision-making measure with distress as the outcome, for men the measure of migration planning appears to be salient when looking at a measure of physical health. And again, I show it graphically with predicted probabilities of reporting excellent or very good physical health status. So again, the yellow bars are just the bivariate relationships, the probabilities that, for example, Cuban male respondents would report excellent physical health status. And then they vary when you consider unplanned versus planned migration, the results actually vary considerably. And then there's a kind of a strange outcome for Puerto Ricans where reporting unplanned migration actually appears to increase the probability of reporting a really good physical health status. So why that is, you know, something I'm interrogating with the data, but quantitative data like this aren't really forthcoming with all of the answers. So just for discussion, just from our analysis, it appears that migration circumstances, including pre-migration measures, are important for predicting health outcomes for Latino immigrants. Again, maybe common sense, but not predictors that you often see in models and kind of your typical model of Latino immigrant health outcomes. And it appears that this varies both by health outcome, whether mental health or physical health, and by gender. And then again, I showed that these pre-migration measures in their effect on health were conditional on Latino ethno-national subgroup. So the acculturation matters, of course, still matter, of course, as we know, we've seen in studies over and over again. But I think, you know, this study shows the importance of considering both pre-migration and reception context circumstances, as well as considering measures of structural inequality and discrimination that were captured in the immigration distress score. So this is a cross-sectional analysis as well. So current health status or distress may shape memories of earlier life experiences. Ideally, I would do separate analyses for different subgroups. I mean, I think it's clear that the different circumstances of migration and settlement for different groups warrant separate analyses, but there just isn't sufficient power to do that. And then I'm limited in these measures of pre-migration context, which are subjective and kind of proxies for, you know, a large set of different circumstances that might have taken place, you know, at any length of time in the past in countries of origin. But I think they maybe begin to make the case for including more of these measures even in survey questions. So my next steps are just to look at more refined measures of pre-migration context and estimating causal models to test mediation of pre-migration circumstances and health by more proximal circumstances related to assimilation and acculturation. And then, as I mentioned in my full migratory phases framework, adapted from Zimmerman to look at the relationships between cross-border ties and health. So, thank you.
Measured immigration pressure as opposed to actual number of foreign-born in the population. So you were looking at percent of foreign-born as a percentage of the total population, and all of those states that were included in the analysis had a 48% or greater growth in immigrant population between 2000 and 2008. So,
but what's the immigrant population?
The immigrant population,
20% of the population?
It was, it ranged. So there was one state in there that was both like a traditional, like Arizona was actually both a traditional receiving state mm-hmm. and a high population growth state, and that was the only one. So the majority of them had relatively low percentages. It was really the increase over time. And so the states that I'm going to add into the next analysis are the states that, like California and New York, you know, that have been these traditional receiving states that have those higher percentages of immigrants, which these states really didn't out of total population. It was just the growth over time was so enormous.
Because I'm wondering, you know, to what extent once the immigrant population size becomes large enough, it actually becomes kind of protective from these policies. I mean, you have New York State's like 46% like immigrant. And so then maybe one of, I don't know how you could survey it really, but just looking at the existence of immigrant civic participation.
I mean, I think
programs, I mean, do they exist in the states? You know, are even in these 10 states, are there any immigrant organizations at all or none?
Well, I mean, I think that's a really great question.
It must be like
I mean, I think it's a great question, but if you, I mean, anecdotally, and that's why I'm hoping to look at the traditional receiving states, but anecdotally, if you look at California, which has one of the highest numbers of immigrants in the entire country, and they still managed to pass that prop.
What was the prop?
180. Yeah. And so, it doesn't seem to be completely protective. It might be, and I'm interested to
but
see
it's
what
it's been protected is. Recently, like in the last few years, like in terms of the whole the reporting to the, you know, getting the licensing the state police and the, you know, local police to do immigrant reporting, and various states, California, Illinois, New York, have now just said that they won't. And I do think it has to do with right. You don't have the health insurance for that, but like. They're significant.
And I think you bring up another good point, which is enforcement versus passing these laws. So there are a lot of states that have passed these laws, but localities have chosen not to enforce it because of the economics of it. It's just literally impossible economic, you know, and plus a lot of the police forces say, well, if we start to enforce this law, then nobody's going to come to us when there really is a problem, and
right.
So there's police enforcement problems. So there's a big difference between what the state says and what actually happens on the ground, and unfortunately I have no way of measuring that. So it you bring up a good limitation.
Did you look at unemployment?
Yes, and it wasn't significant.
It was not. Because I noticed Michigan was high up there.
And it's for some reason the unemployment did not come up significantly. I was really surprised
okay.
by that.
Real stress.
you know, more than what we see now. And now that we get to have a very, very high percentage of immigrants, we're talking of even the documented immigrants, and we have them getting sick the longer they stay in the United States. So when we're talking about our health system, it's even going to be worse off, because we'll be having a lot of sick people. At the same time, most of these people left their country because of economic hardship, and they end up being an American citizen. But at the end of the day, will these people become, what will be the quality of their life when they're in their 50s and their 60s, when they begin to develop all these chronic diseases, you know, diabetes and things like that in their middle age, because of the stress of even being in this country. So at the end of the day, are we talking about what will be their, what will, is it, worth even leaving your country for economic, to better yourself and end up with the even worse quality of life 20, 30 years after you've left your country, that you won't even be able to, produce, to deliver to the society. So that's a real concern, that in the next 20, 30 years, we don't even know what's going to happen to the health of these immigrants.
And that actually speaks to sort of the available data for minority immigrants in general, because we do have a number of different national level data sources, but like as I mentioned, NHANES is not really useful for really assessing the health of Black immigrants. But the National Health and Interview Survey has actually been used to examine differences in disease prevalences in general among Black immigrants, and a lot of the trends that we've been talking about actually have been observed. So we do know that it exists to some extent. It's just that much hasn't been really done about it, and going back to really having enough sample size to really sort of strengthen sort of what we already know, it's something that really needs to be worked on, at least at the national level.
I had a question about the study in Nogal, and I just wanted to make a comment about what you said, but I was curious, when did you collect your data? Yeah, sorry.
Summer 2010 through
okay.
Spring 2011.
So it's basically been sort of post and during drug war, the escalation of the drug war. I'm just curious if that in particular issue came up as part of the interviews, especially I had the privilege of living in Monterey during sort of the initial escalation of the drug war, and I know that when I came back and was interacting with Mexican immigrants in the U.S., they were more afraid of Monterey as people who had not been there recently than I was, and I think that there is among at least people who I know in the Midwest who have not been crossing back and forth and who are documented and are able to do so, there's a fear of crossing right now. Mm-hmm. And I would assume that would be fairly widespread and shared by people who are undocumented. And I was just curious if that particular issue could come up.
Yeah, well, at least in Sonora and in Nogales, which is the main city along southern Arizona, and that major, it was mostly human smuggling, because that's where the human smuggling was all funneled when the walls went up in the mid-90s. But we really saw the drug war escalate in that area begin in 2007, and that's when the drug smuggling kind of took over the human smuggling as well. Before that, they were separate industries, kind of. So as a result of that, almost every woman is raped. Everyone is robbed. Everyone is experiencing violence, where it used to be more every now and then you would hear about that. And so that's partly, this is the first survey we've done where we're actually asking about what they're witnessing, what they're experiencing in terms of the violence. And there's a range of things that have to do with violence, whether it's physical violence or armed violence or rape or that kind of thing. But that's very sensitive too for someone to admit to that.
And I just wanted to also sort of echo your comments. I think that one of the common threads that I see in a lot of what you all are talking about is sort of the importance of like the specificity of knowing where people are from and knowing people's experience. And the United States, we were so excited with ourselves 15 years ago when we finally started asking about Latino, Hispanic and non-Hispanic, and we're like, oh, okay. But I think especially for immigrant populations, it's very important. You can get back into that really, ridiculous argument about how everybody finds themselves.
No, sorry. I have one of them.
Okay, I have two questions. The first one is really quick. For Leslie, you mentioned that most of the immigrants were from South America in your sample. Where were they from?
A number of different South American countries in general. I basically had to group all of them together, so I can't remember off the top of my head. But a lot of them are from Mexico or Mexico. There were some from Puerto Rico, well, just, I think Puerto Rico, Cuba, no, not Cuba. To be honest with you, I really can't remember just because I had to group them together because of the sample size issues. So it's one of those issues where we realize that there's not enough samples, so we just have to, at least, to get any meaningful analysis, just group all sorts of countries into one.
And then my other question was related to translation, what you mentioned, Jackie, about how self-rated health is conceptualized differently in Spanish. And I was just wondering if any of the other researchers found that perhaps in the Iraqi study that was also an issue, or if you can elaborate on this.
So the general issue is just that in Spanish, the translation of fair is regular, and so that's so fair, which would be a bad, like actually predictive of mortality in English, actually is the normative category in Spanish. So my way around that was to actually group the good, fair, and poors because I couldn't control, you can also control for language of interview, but since I had English proficiency as another measure, I would have a multicollinearity problem if I included another language measure. But it is a big issue that if you only include that measure, that in and of itself, language of interview in and of itself would be predictive of health outcomes.
Yeah, we spent a lot of time with that. We had culturally attuned groups who worked with us, but some things you can't, even though they use DSM-IV in Iraq, you know, some things it's very difficult to translate, especially from the tribes and so on. Now, maybe Dr. Jamie want to expand on that.
When we want to translate this instrument, usually if you translate it according to the dictionary, it doesn't work. That is fact. So what you have to do is to group some of the scientists of the same language. They know very well English, but they know the language of the translation, and let them translate it in the way that most of the people understand it, and do a very small pilot study for about 10 to 21. Let them explain what they understand. And this is what we did, in fact, in our all instrument, because all our instrument is translated, but we have a caucus group or a scientific group of, especially they are all public health, the scientists, and they were able to translate it, and we didn't face any problem, in fact, because as I said, we translate the sentences rather than the wording of the word. Yeah.
Thank you. I'm so glad I listened to part of the presentation. My name is Alba Diaz, and I worked for UNICEF for many years, and in a couple of months I'll be presenting in Indonesia. I don't know if you're familiar with the Ulysses syndrome. It has been studied by Dr. Joseba Achetegis in 1982, and he talks about the phase of the pre-migration and compares that to what Ulysses, the memory of the Greek hero, when he leaves Ithaca, what he experienced. And then arriving, and the new phrase, arriving to a new country, and the longing for the country, the saudade, the nostalgia, that experience that many people, when we arrive to that stage, are referred to a mental health provider and are diagnosed as with somebody with depression. And the person is not experiencing depression. And many of them, they say that there are many studies that show the percentage of people that receive antidepressants. And we know the definition of depression. But if people don't want to do anything, they stay in bed, right? But if you tell them there is a job that has been offered and they pay $5 or $6, they jump, they go for that job. There's a class that has our task in health, mental health, is to make sure that we're talking about mental health. It's not a mental illness. And stay away from this diagnosis of depression and over-medicating people who just need to have this network, reconnection. And the image of Ulysses is, speaks by itself. So I just want to highlight that point. Thank you.
Good point.
These are great, great talks, and I'm particularly interested by understanding the post-immigration experience and its consequences. And Mr. Coffia, I didn't quite get how adequate your control for the confounding of time in the U.S. with age was. I saw that you tended to introduce a control for that, but I'd like to hear just some of your sense of did you feel like that statistical control was adequate, or what ought to be done to improve that? And in a similar way, I noticed, Ms. Doris, that almost all your context, post-immigration context variables, are psychological,
right,
are perception. And I, one of the things that I'm interested in is how is it that we sort immigrants into different living experiences in the U.S. How come, I work in the San Joaquin Valley of California, how come some folks from any given state in Mexico end up in sort of connected urban situations versus the least connected rural farm working situations? And how does that sorting occur, and to what extent is it determined by pre-migration experiences? So, complicated questions, but I'd love comments.
That's actually a great question, and it goes back to sort of the data we have available. We know that age is a big factor when controlling for things like that, and even years in the U.S. And for mine, I ended up doing more of a logistic regression as opposed to a linear regression just because of the sample size and also what the data had in terms of variables. So for instance, years lived in the U.S., it had already been categorized when I got access to the data. So there wasn't really much I could do about that. So it boils down to really having a big enough sample to really do more complex analysis. But based on what I had available to me, I was at least able to tease out some of the differences that I presented.
What was the sample size?
It's about a little over 5,000 after I cleaned the data to look at specifically racial and ethnic groups, including minority immigrants or Hispanic groups. The sample size for Black immigrants, I believe, was about 83, so it's very small.
And the Latino group is?
It was over 1,000. It was 1,100 and something.
Okay, so I don't know in terms of an answer about systematic channels of from pre-migration to post-migration settlement. I mean, there's a lot in the sociological literature about the ways in which not only kind of the economic pressures and the kind of dynamics of recruitment and kind of labor situations can influence these channels, but I think social network theory has proved itself to be one of the more salient means by which networks kind of build over time and continue drawing people. So there might be kind of one target person who is recruited. I mean, this is in a non kind of in a labor migration situation, and then social networks kind of take a life of their own, as a lot of sociologists like Douglas Massey would say. I think, so there's a lot of research on selectivity, and I think, I didn't really talk about that research here because the outcome for selectivity is migration, not health. So the kind of the endpoint of selectivity studies is whether or not you migrated, and they never follow up on kind of those settlement studies. So even, I'm in a seminar with Min Zhao, who is the author of the segmented assimilation theory, and I asked her the same question, even in the fields of education or kind of economic outcomes, you know, what do we know about how those selectivity processes carry over long after migration? And she doesn't have an answer even for herself, even though she theorized that they do. Factors do matter.
And Min proposes also that there are objective features of where people settle beyond these psychological measures that you focus on.
Right. Well, yeah, so there's the limitations of the study. But right, yeah, that's right. Yeah, there's institutional factors and structural factors. Yeah.
Any more questions?
So many one of you have studied the work of promotoras, health promoters in the transition post migration.
We look at resilience factors, right? Resilience factors?
The University of California, Berkeley, just published this manual. It was, 3 weeks ago. It's on mental health and how health promoters, community-based workers, are key in assisting in that process. It's all histories from there and from here, Historia de Allá y de Acá, and it's published by University of California School of Public Health.
But there isn't, you're really right, there isn't a body of work that links the sort of the effectiveness of community health workers or access to care and the structure of healthcare systems to these same outcomes. We're always looking at psychological and economic variables and then health outcomes, but very little work that sort of links the immigration-related psychological and economic variables to healthcare access and, as a mediator.
Our study, actually, the one I'm presenting, we funded from NIH to look at that institutional resource, because my theory is that the better access you have to training, integration, etc., the less effect you're going to have of the prior trauma, prior migration trauma. But I think also a lot of this research, you know, doesn't address monitoring or rehab. No unemployment to risk factor for mental health. That's already known since 60 years. It's not integrated into this way of looking at things. And we know, you know, social network plays important. So somehow it surprised me, since I'm coming from refugee research, but our interest is, you know, how can institutional resources like you're describing counteract the adverse effect? We tend to forget some of the knowledge we have in other disciplines. Sustained stress, you know, we know that modifies the brain, and, you know, that has certain effects on learning, et cetera. And that, I think that would be fascinating if you can integrate that knowledge with the experience we've been talking about here. And I think, you know, if we in public health, we shouldn't focus on individual treatment, we should focus on public health intervention for refugees. And we are really, I think that's a big responsibility of policy, like you mentioned, there are policy issues. And I don't hear much of that in the debate. I don't hear much of this in the policy debate when it comes to refugee integration. So that's why we applied, actually, and got the funding to look at, you know, if you move up one perspective, will that have an effect on mental health of trauma-exposed persons compared to regular immigrants?
I think it would be very interesting to look at the earlier immigrants, which are typically European, and the immigrants that we have now in the last 20, 30 years, and see, looking at the health schedule, like, you know, the research say the health of immigrants is your time, to see if that exists with very, very early European immigrants. Because the topic of immigration being very, very significant in the last 20 years, really significant. But there were earlier immigrants that settled down in the United States. To see does the race or the country of where the immigrants come from, does it really make a significant difference in the health status? You understand what I'm trying to say?
Yeah.
It's good to know that, because we're talking of majority of the Latinos now compared to the Europeans 40 years ago. Were the challenges the same? And are their health status the same?
That's actually a good point. I've been actually looking at literature for a while now. My initial field is anthropology, and so when I started out with sort of that in mind, there is some data out there that has actually looked at earlier European immigrants, and it pretty much shows that once Europeans adapt to the American culture, they more or less have very similar health outcomes as non-Hispanic whites. So for them, a lot of the issues that might not an issue for them at all. But then again, I suppose a caveat to that would be that there are different types of Europeans. So for instance, Europeans from Eastern Europe would be very different from, say, Europeans from Britain or something like that. And it goes back to available data at the same time. Don't think we have, or at least I haven't come across in data that shows that we can actually tease out those differences yet.
I just have a question for the acculturation part. How did you test out that? Did you do a selective English Spanish, or how did you do that portion of the acculturation?
What measures they were? Yeah, it was a measure of English proficiency. It was like a 4-item scale asking.
So they self-selected how their English was?
Yeah, there are a lot of other measures in this study, but this is just what's been used by the authors of the study themselves. Just because, I mean, there are a lot more complicated measures. They actually, exactly.
I also have just one last comment. I think it really is important as we move on, we're talking a little bit about Latinos moving and migrating here, to kind of separate them out. I've started doing separating out by country. And one of the reasons for doing that is out of anecdotal sense. For example, if you take Latinos who have migrated here from Guatemala versus someone who's migrated from Honduras, Guatemala has a very high indigenous population, about 82%. So their health status tends to be very different than the types of illnesses that they have, with chronic and not chronic, tend to be very different than somebody else from somewhere else, from another country. So when you take that into consideration, those variables, I think, as we further tease out what the Latino self-identified person is, will change that, their health status and how they either acculturate and how their health status changes from generation to generation, because it will change. In my opinion, I don't necessarily think that it has changed a whole lot from when we had a big migration of Europeans 200 years ago to now. It's still taking 2 to 3 generations for acculturation to happen.